Thank you, Madam Secretary. Now we're going to have another view on the question of Social Security by Mr. George E. Sikorsky, author, journalist, and industrial consultant. And I'll present Mr. Sikorsky.
Ladies and gentlemen, I wish that in this holiday season I could be on the other side of this question. But unfortunately, I find myself driven constantly in all this discussion of economic problems and economic changes in this country to grow more and more conservative, because things don't work out here and things don't work out in Europe. And when things don't work out, we had better watch our steps. The subject, should we plan for Social Security, puzzled me when my friend George Denny asked me to discuss it. Should who plan? The federal government, the state government, individual employers, or the individual himself? Who is the we? For instance, I am privately planning for my own and my family's Social Security, but I am certain that a discussion of that was not intended. Because even though that, in the United States, has been the normal procedure for a century and a half. Again, the word plan puzzles me, because these days everyone seems to have a plan, from Upton Sinclair's epic to Dr. Townsend's Carnival of the Dodderers. Curiously enough, all the plans look fairly sound on paper, particularly as they are all prepared by sincere persons who want to help humanity. But we must have more than sincerity. We must have a philosophy of action, a measure of conduct, so that we are not constantly to be shifted about from one theory of life and government to another. We want to know in which direction these plans are leading us. The people of every country today face the same political and economic problems. Everywhere, men and women are seeking for stability and security, not only in national existence, but in their individual lives. Everywhere, the dangers of uncertainty, of insecurity, of the fear that comes from insecurity, forces men and women not only to search for more perfect economic systems, but even to question the wisdom of existing political structures. It is obvious that in a measure, perfect security can be achieved by reducing the entire population to a fixed caste stratification, as was done in India. There, each individual within his caste enjoyed complete security, but few enjoyed little else. But we cannot accept security at that cost, nor does anyone propose that we should here. On the other hand, in Europe, it has been proposed and it has been accepted that for the sake of security, for the sake of intensified state efficiency, men should sacrifice all human rights, all liberties won by centuries of human struggle for the single right of being assured a modicum of bread during the whole of one's existence. In many countries, war-ridden, post-war suffering individuals have actually paid that price for a government-promised security. In Germany, Russia, Italy, and many other countries, all human rights have been concentrated in a political dictatorship. The individual subjecting himself to the whim and will of such leadership in the hope that only by such avoidance of the inefficiencies of democracy can security be achieved. Democracy and the capitalist system have their values, but they can never hope to be perfectly efficient, nor to produce an utter equality. the very liberties which they guarantee produce a measure of waste and a measure of ineffective and even futile operation. The very nature of a profit and loss system in economics and of a town hall system of politics is predicated upon such a measure of lost motion. It is altogether possible that under a dictatorship, perfect efficiency for the individual and for the collective citizenry of the state is possible. Under dictatorships, men can be forced into a virtual economic slavery with subsistence guaranteed by the state. They can eat, and as a matter of fact, their standards of living in time may be as high as ours, but they cannot hope to be free, hope to differ, hope to consult, free to debate as we are doing tonight. They must obey or go to a concentration camp. Can you imagine? Can you imagine a mere journalist debating a state problem with a cabinet officer in Russia or Germany or Italy? Human liberty, my friends, is a rare privilege, not lightly gained, nor is it to be sacrificed for bread alone. For without it, the guaranteed, the secured bread becomes the wages of a driven slave. There are no poor, no unemployed, no indigent. But I also want liberty. I want the human rights, which my ancestors never enjoyed, but which to me are more precious than life. For without them, life is a conscious of crushing death. It is upon this basis that I shall now devote myself to the specific plan for Social Security, the Federal Government Social Security Act, passed by Congress, signed by the President, now the law of the land. When we talk of that, we have something very specific before us, pretty close to $5 billion annually within the next 15 years, to be met by taxes, which will produce increased prices, reduced profits, and possibly even reduced employment of labor. We need not be abstract or idealistic about this plan. It is here with us, and we have to face it. Curiously enough, one of the first obstacles we encounter in this plan arises from our form of government. Clearly, the right to provide for unemployment insurance rests with the state. But the federal government has the right to tax its citizens. The authors of this bill face there a dilemma which in time we must all encounter. They wanted to do something which they are not allowed to do. They got around their difficulty by a very simple device. They would tax all the payrolls of the United States, and then they would remit 90% of the tax if the burdened citizens could force their state legislatures to pass such an act as the federal government wanted passed. Here is a new principle of politics, a new departure from liberty. The federal government cannot coerce the states to pass a law, but it can offer the citizens of each state a base, a monetary base to have the law passed. 90% of the federal tax is to be remitted if the state passes a law to conform to federal standards. The remaining 10% remains with the federal government. But the federal government does not engage in the unemployment insurance business, except to make grants in aid for administrative purposes to the state. The actual administration of the business is admittedly the function of the state. Therefore, the remaining 10% has no function. It is either a clear profit for the federal government, a hidden form of taxation, or it is a service charge for coercion. But we go a step further. The federal government has set up certain standards for the state. The remission of the 90% to the citizens of each state is to be made available only if the state has fulfilled certain requirements. These requirements give the federal government a control over state administration not intended in our form of government. The theory of the act is that the state administration must be subject to the control of the Social Security Board. But the act does not guarantee that the states may not tax additional amounts, nor does it, as the Social Security Board clearly pointed out itself, prescribe the kind of unemployment compensation plan which the states must adopt, except for a few minimum standards. So that after an employer paid 1% in 1936, and 2% in 1937, and 3% in 1938 and thereafter on his payroll, the states can levy additional sums, which are partly to be offset by the remitted 90%. There are no limitations upon the size of the state levy, and it may vary in different states. How will the employer meet the federal unemployment and old age and state unemployment taxes? Four separate taxes. Wherever he can, he will pass it on to the consumer. That makes of the measure a disguised sales tax. When, because of competitive prices or sales resistance, or for other reasons, he cannot pass the tax on, he will take it out of profits, if any, or by increased mechanization, increased labor-saving devices, decreased employment. As profits are currently either small or merely prospective, many firms will immediately go out of business through this increased burden, thus increasing the danger of monopolistic enterprise in the United States. As seasonal or occupational labor, have much time, increases the tax bill of the employer, he will either avoid taking on new men, or he will seek and probably find ways for increasing the work time of his current staff. In a word, nothing in the act itself encourages one to feel that it will lessen unemployment or benefit the small businessman. Here the plan seeks to be so complete and perfect that it confuses its own objective. Again, I am moved to comment on the excluded classification. Seven classes are excluded from both the tax and the benefits. A saxophone player employed in a nightclub would benefit, but a violinist of the Philharmonic would be excluded. A nurse in Mount Sinai Hospital would be excluded, but a nurse in a private hospital would benefit. Farm labor and seamen would be excluded, but longshoremen would benefit. Surely if the objective is unemployment insurance, and in the other matter, old age pensions for those who labor, how can a distinction be made between one laborer and another? How can it be said that an elevator boy in the Empire State Building should enjoy the benefits of this act, and an elevator boy here in the town hall should not? Yet the act says just that. Old age, according to the act, begins at 65, and in the year 1942. Therefore, our immediate problem, that is 7.5 million persons of 65 and over today, of whom 1 million are now on relief, is not solved except by relief measures, that is, grant in aid, different name, same thing. And the amount eventually to be paid as a pension is quite trivial. Wages paid in and after 1937 are the base. To get the maximum of $85 a month, a man would have had to work 45 years at a salary of $250 a month without interruption. No one, therefore, can possibly receive the maximum of $85 a month until 1982, which is a long way off. To get any benefit, even as low as $10 a month, a man must have worked 5 years after 1936, during which he received a total of $2,000. The man who is now around the 60s, unemployed, and who does not get a non-governmental, non-municipal job, the lights are driving me, by 1937 may be permanently out of luck. No man who is now over 60 can qualify, because it is necessary to work 5 years before reaching the age of 65 after 1936. Those old folks must still go to the poorhouse or get relief in some manner. Ladies and gentlemen, I've got to skip. I could not, in the few minutes that I've had, and I've skipped four paragraphs, analyze this bill in detail. I have not touched on its financial setup, on the dangers of vast government reserves, and the concentration of liquid wealth in government bonds, on taxation problems, on the constitutional aspects of the bill. I had time only to deal with such phases of this measure as arose from my original premise, namely, does this bill endanger our liberties, even if it does provide a greater economic security than now exists, which I deny. I think that I have indicated that its benefits are trivial, its administration confused, I have to leave that out, and its plan of uncertain advantage. But even if it were perfect, I should echo the words of William Green, president of the American Federation of Labor in the 1931 convention. We can't have unemployment insurance without agreeing to a setup that will, to a large degree, govern and control our activities. You can't have it all one way. If you are to agree to submit consideration to this proposal and the operation of this plan, then you must be willing to give up some of the things you now possess. And what can we, Mr. Green is talking, give up and yet maintain our movement? You can't have an employment insurance plan without employment exchanges. You can't have unemployment insurance plan without registration. You must report. You must subject yourself in every way to the control of the law. There must be, to make this system function efficiently, a card catalog of millions of names with case histories. And all that would be necessary to make those card catalogs fully efficient, as in Germany, would be a fingerprint added to it. But I go even further than Mr. Green and say to you, watch your individual liberties. Safeguard your human rights. We must in this country remain a democracy in which the federal government is the servant, not the master of the state and of the individual citizens. No, they'll give me a light. No $15 a month pension, nor even Dr. Townsend's $200 a month pension can compensate us for the concentration of power in the federal government which these measures involve. We are naturally torn between two emotions. We despair at unemployment and hunger in old age. And yet we fear even more the consequences of government control of our lives, because we know the terrors of that. We must achieve a corrected distribution of wealth through a wider participation of the worker in the earnings of industry by constant employment, for a higher standard of living, and for an equalization of opportunity. But whatever we do, let it remain within the framework of a democracy of sovereign states and free individuals.
At this point in America's town meeting of the air, we pause for station identification.